CliffCentral.com.
All right. Good morning, if you've just joined us. CliffCentral.com on a Friday morning. Bulelo's got a brand new show for you today. And by the way, it's all in HD, so you can see every detail of the set. You can see what's going on Bulelo's computer. You can, I mean, I watched it on my big screen the other day, and it's so cool. I suppose awesome. Now there's pressure for us to put this show into HD as well, but then we'll need HD cameras everywhere, because that's what you've got, right?
We got some 6K cameras actually, so we'll turn it right up. Oh, wow. We're not playing. Cliff nice. Central's not playing now.
Nice.
Cliff Central, as a company, we're not playing.
It's
been awesome.
Speaking of new shows and things that are going on in shows, we have a brand new show on Cliff Central, Life with Lebang, which started yesterday. You know Lebang, who was on the show on Wednesday here, and someone I introduced to you about 2 weeks ago. She's on fire. So not only has she joined Cliff Central in an official capacity where she's going to be handling a lot of our creative stuff, but she's also got her own show, and I encourage you to listen to it. It's called Life with Lebang. She says, when life gives you lemons, blah, blah, kumbaya. Consider her show a safe space if that's what you're into. You can join her as she talks about everyday conversations and situations, but in a not-so-conventional way. You can listen live at 11 on a Thursday, or you can get the podcast at cliffcentral.com. on the Cliff Central app or Spotify or wherever you listen. So go and do that ASAP, and you can find Lebang's new show. See, we're bringing back some new shows. We're bringing back live shows, and it's starting to happen, but we're being very picky about what we put on. So there's Cliff Central Sport for you with Mbulelo. There's Life with Lebang, and there are a couple other really good shows you can listen to on cliffcentral.com. All right, Leanne Moles here. Bulelo's here, I'm here, and you are here. That's all that matters this morning. We've got this incredible story of the Devilsdorp documentary, which we're going to talk about in a short while. Apparently, it's taking over all over the place. I just want to refer quickly to something that came up yesterday while we were talking with Pumi. And this is about the discussion we were having about people who emigrated from South Africa in the early 90s and how many of them only left for, you know, racist reasons. I know that that's not true for everybody, so don't think I'm talking about you if it's not you. That's on you if you take it on. But here's the story. So I got an email from Steve. He says, towards the end of last year, I moved to the UK with my fiance. I'm 27 years old. And Steve says, I was recently talking with a family that had moved here about 15 years ago about their generation of the South African community in the UK. They told me that naturally when they arrived on foreign soil, they sought out fellow South Africans and would even invite them over for a braai, even if they'd just met on a train. This exercise was an eye-opener, as 90% of the families that came were hardcore racists that left South Africa for that very reason. This is Steve's story about this other family. Fast forward to today, and he says he reckons 99% of the people that are in his generation that he's met in the UK have emigrated for the following reasons, in this order. Are you ready? Number one, they want to be able to travel in and out of Europe easily. I understand that. Number two, career opportunities. Just finding a job is much easier there. Mm. Number three is career progression. In other words, you've started something, but you want to be able to progress to the next level, and that wasn't available to them in South Africa or perhaps in other countries too. Number four, financial reasons. Number five, avoidance of crime. He says, I've not come across any person who's moved due to racism. I don't know whether there are fewer racists in younger generations or we're just better at holding our tongues, but I certainly think it is the former. I think most of us are emigrating for healthy reasons and positive ones, and it's been refreshing to note this contrast. So I just thought I'd bring that up because we talked about it yesterday, and I think there is a huge difference. Steve, I completely agree with you in terms of the people I know who've moved, who've emigrated, who've decided to change their lives, whether it was from or to South Africa, and I completely concur with everything that you've just said. So I'm glad we got this email from Steve. Thanks, man.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. There. It's definitely been a change. And I mean, I speak from experience in that as well, where a lot of my family, my dad's side of the family, immigrated a long time ago.
Mm.
I'm talking 20 years ago.
Right.
And those reasons were definitely crime related, because they'd all been victims of crime,
mm.
but mainly because of their business, which had reached its peak here. However, when they started it up overseas, it did suffer. It was
sure.
It's a different ball game.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we posted that link after I spoke about that documentary yesterday. You might want to go and see that as well. We're going to talk Devilsdorp in a minute or two, and Jana Marx will be our guest. She's the author of the book based on the investigation into these incredible killings, and we'll find out from her how it turned into a documentary. I mean, many people are saying they didn't really care about Showmax until this, and now they're suddenly
or
Krugersdorp. Yeah, lots of people saying Krugersdorp can miss me. I have no reason to go there. Apparently, listen to this. This is pretty wild. My husband, says Brigitte, went to Krugersdorp High, and they used to call it Krugerfornia. 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 Yes, that is a hard one to say. Imagine being drunk and trying to say Krugerfornia. Oh,
excellent. Krugerfornia.
Tongue twister.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, if you use it in its purest accent, it would be Krugerfornia.
Krugerfornia.
Yeah, it's like an art by Krugerfornia.
Yeah, I've never been to Krugersdorp, eh?
Never. Oh, really?
No. Furthest.
Fantastic. What's wrong with you?
Fantastic.
Please, I'm terrified.
You are not missing anything. You're not.
It's the first time.
How do you know, Mbulelo? You've been there?
No, well, my aunt, I told you, my aunt lives in Eagle Canyon. Eagle Canyon.
That's not Krugersdorp.
As far as I'm concerned. Yeah, and also we had to play cricket once against Krugersdorp High, so. But I've never voluntarily gone to Krugersdorp. No,
I've had lots of friends who live in Krugersdorp, and also I've mentioned quite often that fantastic fancy dress shop, which is it's just a fantasy world, which it's built to look like a castle.
That
and
sounds
it's just
cool.
In some random main street in Krugersdorp West.
Okay,
but Krugersdorp West is like really hitting the boundary.
Krugersdorp West is even first. You have to go through Krugersdorp to get to Krugersdorp West.
Yes. And it's the first time I saw a Bakuzi, and I was driving behind it. I was on my way to the fancy dress shop, and there was a gigantically obese mom and daughter in the back of the bucky, which was lined with plastic and filled with water. And they were just chilling in the
Bakuzi. That's so... a Bakuzi in Krugerfornia. Yes. That's a new world.
Yeah, hey. I must tell you. Mm. Yeah, I'm a little bit surprised by that, because having heard all of your incredible stories from your life, I would have thought Bathurst would have been a part of your childhood. I don't know if you've ever been to Oxbry before. Did you ever go to Oxbry?
No, I haven't. It's one place
I'm very surprised by that. Yeah, yeah. Because for those who don't know, Oxbry, the party of all parties. If you are between the ages of 18 and 23, Bathurst, Oxbry.
So Bakuzi's everywhere. What happens is that Bakuzi Central when, I mean, you've been there, so tell us, because I've never been to Oxbry either. So give us the lowdown.
So at Oxbry, you kind of drive into this this field, right? That's meant to be like a big, think of it as a festival.
Okay.
So you drive into a field, you can't leave. So it's very much like New Zealand, really. It's a mix between... Afghanistan and New Zealand.
And this is in Bathurst. So,
Bathurst. So you drive in there, music's pumping, the Oaks and the Bettys are out there, you know, the shirts come off, sun's out, guns out, sun's out, buns out. And then, the Bakuzis are everywhere. So you can set up your car, you can have all of your own stuff, you pay for a ticket, and then you all eat the spit braai when it's ready. It's just music and... Okay. Debauchery for 24 hours, and then you can leave the next morning.
Carolyn says, I'm lying. She says, Gareth, you're lying. I remember seeing you at you were DJing at the local news cafe in Krugersdorp. You know what? I think you might be right.
Integrity.
No, I forgot. I mean, I obviously put it out of my mind.
Trauma. It's the trauma that they say.
Post-traumatic stress. Events. Yeah. Well, I have the trauma. I have this. Listen, I'm not going to bullshit you. I have this unique ability to be able to forget unsavory and unpleasant experiences. I forget them. I forget the, like if you and I had a fight.
I do, yeah, I'm exactly the same.
If you and I had a fight.
Other people remind me.
Yeah. And we really said terrible things to each other, and there was maybe even a bit of violence. I would not remember it. by tomorrow, and I'd be as normal as I am now with you. It's weird. It just gets stored in some file in a vault in my head, and it just doesn't get opened again. It just gets put in there. There's some experience, obviously, so I learn from it, and then it just gets shelved, and it never gets revisited. I'm not one of those people who dwells on bad experiences, and maybe it's a survival technique. Maybe I'm avoiding stuff. I don't know, but it gets put away. Don't deal with it. Maybe that would have helped me.
That's not on you.
No, but maybe that would have helped me if I had been in Krugersdorp during this unbelievable story. And really, you know, I've been excited to talk to Jana for such a long time now, because this documentary is just a runaway success. So in case you don't know what we're talking about, there's this brilliant series. It's the first Showmax original true crime series that they've ever had, Devilsdorp, and it has broken records. It's been watched more in its first 4 days of launch than Game of Thrones was watched, or any of the other local shows that have been put on. And it is just unbelievable. It's a four-part series. It investigates the 11 Krugersdorp killings that happened between 2012 and 2016, separately known as the Appointment Murders and the Satanic Murders, and how they were all traced back to this one woman, Cecilia Stein. And she was the head of the Electus Per Deus, which is the Chosen by God cult. So we're joined this morning by the journalist and author of the Krugersdorp cult killings, Inside Cecilia Stein's Reign of Terror. Her name is Jana Marks, and she joins us this morning. She also narrates the series, and she's here. First of all, thanks for your time. I believe there are just a ton of people who are chasing you at the moment to get interviews. You've been really in demand. You've been so busy. Well done, Jana.
Good morning, Gareth and team. Now, it's a wonderful opportunity to be here. I've been busy. Yeah, I've been extremely busy. I say my biggest regret these past few weeks is not putting in leave at work to actually do this, you know. But I mean, who would have known? I think we wanted the good public, positive public response, but I think no one expected this explosion.
But what a story. I mean, listen, this is the kind of story that some journalists wait their whole lives to be able to have. It's got all the elements that you need to make people sit up and take notice. There's a bit of Satanism. There's murder. There's abuse. There's, you know, the violence. There's all the stuff that would make people think this can't be true. This is like the script of a bad 90s horror movie. But it's all true. And you were actually there to witness all of this. You've met the people involved in this. What an unbelievable inside track you've had. How do you feel when you go to sleep at night? Are you scared?
No, I won't say I'm scared. I've been a bit freaked out while I work through the dockets. Just to give you an idea, the footage you see on Devilsdorp and the pictures you see in the book, we've already filtered them. You know, there are just some things we can't show people. Otherwise, we have to increase the age restriction. So. Yeah. That there was a time while I was working through the police dockets, looking at these photos, when I had a bit of trouble sleeping.
I'm sure.
But for me to understand the story and for me to be able to recreate the scenes and exactly understand what happened there, what went on in people's minds at that point, I needed to study those photos like I think last time I studied so hard was in matric.
So just tell us quickly, because I'm trying to understand it from your point of view, because you're telling all of us the story, but how did you actually get involved in this story? How did you become the person who was in charge of reporting on this and who eventually obviously wrote what was a screenplay for a documentary? How did this happen?
I've been a core journalist at that time. So, you know, people want the fabulous story of how this became my case. Mm. There's no such story because it was one of the many cases on my diary. Mm-hmm. But I usually get the indictment beforehand and I work through it the previous night just to know what I'm getting into if I attend a new case the following day. And while I was reading through this, it was about 40 pages of indictment. I realized this is a mess. Mm. This is a complete mess. And I remember I've just finished a case. It was actually about child abuse. And I thought, oh my goodness, you know, it can't really get worse than that. Mm-hmm. And then I met Cecilia Stein.
Jesus. Okay. So first time you met her, we've got to hear about that.
Yeah. So I started to attend the case the moment it was transferred from the lower court to the high court. I obviously you see her in court, you make eye contact, you're not really allowed to speak to them as a journalist. Obviously they are represented by the legal counsel.
Right.
But you will try to get a word in here or there just to see how this person is. When I actually met her was downstage, the court there at the holding cells below. And I accompanied her parents when they went down during a lunch break to quickly go and visit her. So, yeah, that's when we actually formally met. Hi, Jan. Hi, Cecilia. I'm Jana.
And what did she say? And how did she appear to you? And what were you looking for? Because you already knew what she'd supposedly been involved in and what we've subsequently found out she was very much involved in. What was it like meeting her? And what were your first impressions? What did you take away from that meeting and subsequent ones?
I was very unimpressed. And I know she'll hate to hear this, but I really was. For a cult mastermind.
Yes.
To have the defense that she had absolutely no defense. She didn't come to court ready to fight these charges.
No.
Her defense was one of denial. I can't remember. Oh, yeah, no. I wasn't present. I was one of my other personalities was surfacing at that point. So I didn't really know what was going on there. I mean, that's not how a clever cult mastermind operates. That was what actually went through my mind. And when I met her in the holding cells, she spoke to me as if she'd never seen me, but we've been in court for about 30 days before that. She's like,
She
was like unamused.
So obviously, but also like a little bit disconnected, right?
I think so, but it's also part of the game. You know, she wants to be in charge. She wants to drive the narrative. The fact that I'm a journalist and now I'm writing the story. She doesn't like that.
But
because I'm writing what I'm hearing and that doesn't correspond what she wants me to believe.
But you don't.
So I'm not her favorite person.
But you'd almost think that if she was as clever as so many people said she was to have created this cult and to have got all these people doing her bidding, you'd think that she would be smart enough to realize, like, you're the one who's going to tell her story. So the person she needs to keep the closest and let in on all the secrets is you. But you say she doesn't like you.
She doesn't like me, no. And I realized, I had an opportunity to talk to her, to actually get an interview with her. But at that stage, I was writing the book, and it was a factual series of events. I realized from her testimony in court, she's not going to contribute anything worthwhile for me for the book. So I just decided, if I ever want to interview a serial killer, I will contact her. I know how to reach her. But for the cases for the facts of this case, I really don't need her input. We all know what she did.
Jeez. All right. So let's get into this. I mean, do you really think it was the work of Satan? Do you think that this had any satanic seriousness to it? Or do you think that this was just a bunch of psychopaths who had strong religious beliefs? And do you think that she was just good at manipulating people? Remember in the 1980s and 90s, there was this satanic panic in South Africa. Everybody thought there were Satanists everywhere and they were sacrificing cats and people. And like, it was mostly bullshit. Do you think that this was mostly bullshit? Or do you think that that was the cover that they used to make it sound really nefarious and insidious and dangerous?
I even want to go one step back. Cecilia didn't even fabricate her own version of Satanism. That's the thing. She used the cover of Satanism. She used the cover of Christianity. But even people that belong to the Satanic Church or people that belong to the Christian Church will not be able to associate with whatever she preached and believed. And that was actually very interesting when I did my research. So I started to Google because I want to know, I know there are different bodies, or maybe sects, but versions of Satanism.
Right. Yeah.
And I wanted to know where does she fit in? So I started to Google and I just realized, but she's nowhere. She took a little bit of this, a little bit of that. There's a bit of Hinduism there. There's a bit of extremist, like Islamic beliefs there. There's a bit of abuse of Christianity in there.
Yeah.
And she just fabricated whatever she called Satanism, fabricated whatever she called Christianity to suit her purpose. There was absolutely no true religion or as people know, religion or religion people belongs to in this story.
But it did, it worked to like lure people in, and it also worked obviously in making the story that much more saucy, right? Because it adds that occult Absolutely. Element, which is just, for some people, that's way more interesting than the actual murders.
Yeah, and that also makes it a bit more difficult to distinguish between the facts and the nonsense. And that's actually something a prosecutor or a note he made in court is that the moment you pour religious sauce over crimes, mm-hmm. things become muddy. So mm-hmm. he's a Christian, and he just said, I'm not going to get into anything of this. This is cold-blooded murders, and we are going to prosecute cold-blooded murders.
And why was she, I mean, if you boil it down, it turns out that this is really just a revenge plot that just went on way too long and that got way too complicated. I mean, it's not as sexy as this woman, the Cecilia Stein, wanted it to sound. And she's not some mastermind, and this isn't some, you know, modern-day revelation of some ancient religious nonsense. It's actually just a pathetic human being who decided to take revenge just a step too far and a few more steps beyond that even. Is that a fair kind of synopsis of what really went on here? Explain to us what the revenge was. I mean, like, go back to the beginning.
Yeah, that's my view. And I just want to add to that, Gareth, before I go back to the beginning. If you look at Cecilia's strategy, I mean, we've all watched the Charles Manson docus or the Sons of Sam, David Berkovich.
Yeah.
If you actually go back now, after you watch Devil's Door, and you go watch those docus again, you'll see, oh my goodness, this looks familiar. This looks familiar. So even her cult was this made up thing from other people's cults.
Yeah, badly.
Just show how
badly cobbled together. She was picking and choosing stuff to make it sound more exciting than it was. But who was the revenge against in the beginning? And what happened in her life to turn her into this?
So Cecilia had this mentor called Ria Groenewald, and Ria at that stage had her own ministry, and that ministry worked with recovered Satanists or survivors. So if someone was in the satanic church and they wanted to get out of it, for whatever reason, then Ria and her group was there to just welcome them and help them. And it's just this whole recovering to Christianity, from Satan to God, you know, that whole journey.
Sure.
So that was where Ria fit in. So when Cecilia crossed the path, I mean, Ria thought, oh my goodness, one of the witnesses called it, it was Ria's trophy moment. You know, this was the one big case in her life that she really can make a difference or really can assist out of the cult. I mean, Cecilia professed to be the bride of Satan. So there isn't a higher rank Satanist than except for Satan himself.
Right.
So Ria thought, okay, this was something special. This person must be extremely special if God wants to save the bride of Satan. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
And then they started to walk the journey, and Cecilia became very involved in Ria's ministry, up to a point where Ria's whole life centered around Cecilia. Because Cecilia, part of her whole game or her story was that she needed protection, as she was this important witch in her prior life. She now needed all the protection she could get to not go back, to not be drawn back into the claws of Satan.
Right.
So that's where Ria fits in. And at a point there, fall out because Ria just realized, this woman can't consume my life. I need to still earn an income. Because Ria was literally in her house, like almost 24/7. She couldn't really do anything else.
No, there was a toxic, toxic codependency that developed, yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So Ria just decided, okay, you know, I need to get some distance between us. And Cecilia didn't take that well. And she retaliated. That's actually what she did. So she decided she wanted to hurt Ria, but you can't hurt someone if you kill her.
Mm-hmm.
So the best way to hurt her is to actually hurt people around her. So that's where the revenge came in.
So the people that she brainwashed to commit all these murders, those people seem like they're really, really dumb and gullible, if you ask me. And having seen the documentary too, the little bits that I have seen, because I've got two episodes to go. But these people who did her dirty work, how much of this was just a bunch of bored people who had nothing going on in their lives? They were just looking for attention.
That's what's actually so interesting. Not everyone has a low intellectual level there. You have Zach Valentine, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's absolutely brilliant. Mm-hmm. He studied actual sciences. He at that stage, he was making a lot of money working for an insurer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was a clever guy. So it almost doesn't make sense. How would he fall for something like that?
Let's be fair. Insurance and Satanism have always been bedfellows. We all know. So, all right. Tell me about this Valentine guy.
Yeah. So Valentine is the one guy. When I started to do my research, you know, everyone, if I look at the members of the cult, there is something, you know, we won't always know what led to them, you know, doing what they did at the end. But there was always something that I said, and I thought, okay, you know, this might have been a trigger, or this might have contributed to whatever, what to them becoming killers afterwards, or later in the game. But Zach Valentine, if you speak to his friends, they will just tell me, like, one after the other, we can't believe it. Not Zach, not this nice guy. He was the guy that you would call in varsity. You had a few drinks, you needed someone to pick you up. He's the one you will call. Or the one you will call to drop in at 3 a.m. before you go home, just to get a bit sober so you can show you can go home the proper way. So he was that guy. He got very, very good marks for all his subjects. There's actually nothing there that shows me, okay, yeah, something was off. Something was off, so yeah, it makes sense now.
I hate this. I don't watch a lot of crime and investigation stuff, but it always irritates me that we can never link up the way someone behaved before they became a psychopathic killer and the way they become afterwards. It's always so frustrating to me that we don't have any telltale signs. And what you're telling me about this guy is there was no telltale sign here too. How did he end up being? How did he end up being a servant of this Cecilia Stein woman?
He was gullible. That's the one thing all of his friends agreed on. And not even gullible, but he had a craving for attention and to be part of a group, because he was always kind of the academic loner. He had a lot of friends, but he wasn't the cool guy. So he wanted approval. And I just think Celia gave him this ground to grow all of his insecurities. And she played him. She played him in that way. And in such a way that, I mean, he was part of the killing of his wife. So it's, you know, it didn't even become worse. It became like the worst actual example of a serial killer that you can imagine.
Now, what about all these cops? This I found interesting because I didn't know about this until the documentary either. All these cops who helped to cover up the crimes for her, they were also influenced so heavily by Cecilia, right?
These cops are actually now under investigation. I'm like sitting on the point of my chair to, you know, to listen what's going to come out of this. The police did investigate charges of defeating the ends of justice. So the police investigated their own. The anti-corruption unit investigated the four members. And defeating the ends of justice is the one charge, and the other one is being accessory after the fact, which would mean that being alleged that they covered up the crimes. The docket has been handed over to the MPA. The MPA has to decide on prosecution, but the MPA told me on Friday that they are not quite ready to make a decision. They still need more evidence for the investigation, for the docket. So, but it's a good sign. At least they're working on it.
But it is ongoing. And somehow she managed to get these cops to help her cover things up. You think when people go missing and they've been killed, you'd think there'd be more of a fuss made. You think there's something odd going on in Krugersdorp? Do you think Krugersdorp's a strange place?
Could this have happened anywhere? Yeah. Or could it only have happened in Krugersdorp?
Is this a Krugersdorp-specific killing spree?
I see there's a lot of jokes about Krugersdorp going on. The one TV channel is actually renaming Krugersdorp since this morning, so it's quite funny. but I grew up in Bloemfontein.
Okay.
And I can tell you that even there, you can see it's the same kind of community, very Afrikaans, very religious. So I don't really think it's a Krugersdorp thing, as it's more of a Kleindorpy thing.
Yeah. And more of a cultural, you know, wherever there's huge conservatism and maybe a huge amount of religiosity, there tends also to be an enormous desire to rebel among certain people in those communities. And rebelling in the most extreme form for a Christian would be to become a Satanist. And rebelling in the most extreme form for a conservative Afrikaans person would be to, you know, become an arch-liberal, completely embarrassing to the community kind of outlier. And maybe that's something that we need to explore in terms of culture in this country. It's definitely interesting. All right, so one of the most chilling aspects of the story is how the children of Marinda Steyn were dragged into this. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about that behind the scenes and what stuff you had to leave out of the documentary even about that, because that's some scary stuff that happened there.
Yeah, the children were very small when Marinda became friends with Cecilia. And obviously, is that a thing, if your mom goes to Bible study, then you'll go along. Mm-hmm. At that stage, Marinda wasn't married. She's been married three times to that point. Mm-hmm. So the children were living with her. She was the
guardian.
She had sole custody, yeah. And the children they grew up with Cecilia. They even testified, you know, that she was like a second mom. Cecilia also played the role of discipline and all that. So it wasn't even strange for Marinda when Marcel turned 14. It's actually quite shocking. That Marinda decided, okay, you know what, Marcel, this is now my. I feel like there's a Bible story with Hannah, mm-hmm. the little child Samuel, and then she dedicates Samuel to Eli to grow up in the tabernacle. Now that's exactly mm-hmm. how Marinda saw Cecilia as Eli, mm-hmm. and she gave Marcel up to go and stay with Cecilia. So Marcel became the housekeeper. She looked after the children. She did the homework. She cooked. This 14-year-old girl, it was supposed to be in school. And she still got 6 distinctions in matric, which just shows how amazing intellectual she is. Mm. But yeah, there are actually 2 parts to this. People have a lot of sympathy with the children because, I mean, what can you do if you're small, you're being dragged into these things against your will, or you maybe don't know of any better. And we know that they were isolated, they didn't have any friends, they weren't allowed to take friends home and all that. But I do have a very strong position on this. Eventually, those children grew up. And the children, LaRue is just a few years younger than me. And I remember even when I was still in school, we were constantly told, if you have a problem, you can talk to this teacher. If you have a problem with this, you can talk to that teacher. If you don't feel comfortable, there's the school psychologist. So that was the defense of the children, especially Marcel. She was too scared. She couldn't talk to anyone. That's what she told the court. But yeah, I have a lot of sympathy for the children being small, but eventually they grew up. And at some point you realize this is not shoplifting. People are losing their lives. And if you know right from wrong, you have to do something about this. You can't just go along.
When you've been around people who've done these heinous things and you've seen how many lives have been ruined by the madness of this cult and of Cecilia and Marinda and all of this stuff, what do you think evil really is? Because we all have a definition of evil in our heads. We all like, well, it's someone who's so selfish that they don't care who they hurt along the way. Or evil is something mysterious and religious and something ancient that is the opposite of good. How do you define evil, especially having been around these people?
I think evil can translate in the way of killing. It's one thing to shoot someone. It's cold. It's it's far. It's distant. These people decided to kill people with a knife, to stab people 60, 70 times. So I think it can be translated in the way crimes are committed. But I also think the ultimate evil is what Zuck did, to kill your wife, to kill the person that dedicated her life to you. It's not someone far away. It's not you're not gaining in any way. Mm. You're not gaining financially. You are not even gaining what Cecilia is gaining, which is that personal revenge satisfaction. I just think there's just no excuse for that. The killings are senseless on a whole new level for me.
And Jana, when you think about the story and all the things that you've witnessed, what is the most disturbing part of that for you? Are there still things about it that keep you up? Are there still things about it that you can't get out of your head? Being able to do a documentary like this is a tremendous cathartic experience, I'm sure. Writing the book was something very helpful in dealing with this, and for everyone else to deal with it too, because we tend to think we're in a modern society, these sorts of things don't happen. You know, they happen in Hollywood, or they happen in like very weird parts of the world where people are a little isolated from them. This is just a few kilometers to the west of Johannesburg. This is close for many of us. The fact that this was going on while all of us were just going about our daily business is frightening. So are there things about it that still bug you now?
That's exactly what you said. I think that's the big thing. What makes the story so bizarre and so relatable to so many people. Coming from Bloemfontein, I thought, you know, evil lies in the outskirts.
Yeah.
You trust your teacher with your life. You trust your gym instructor with your life. And suddenly, I just think this case made me realize crime is amongst us. It's not something, even in South Africa, it's not something that's out there. It's not something that I can live far from and not cross paths with. I need to be vigilant. I need to not be paranoid, though, but I need to be aware. And I think this is the times that we live in. We're going to see a lot more of these things. And the second thing is the religion part. The fact that we have so many cult groups. I mean, Cecilia Steyn, they went to extremes to kill people. But you remember the Doom Prophet, the guy that sprayed the insect repellent in the congregants' faces.
Yes.
And the angels' ministries and all that. We have a huge problem in South Africa with unregulated cults, because they are cults.
Mm-hmm.
Or they call themselves independent churches.
Yeah.
So we really need to do something about this, because it is creeping. It's coming closer and closer and closer. It's not out there anymore. These people, they walk amongst us.
it's frightening. Leanne and Bolelo, you've seen the series as well. I'm sure there's plenty of stuff you want to ask Jana. This is your chance. She's in huge demand at the moment. She's doing interviews with people all over the world. And she's done such a great job with this documentary. Of course, it's not just her, but she does narrate it, and she did write the book. So there's a whole team of people that we've also got to give credit to for an incredible show.
Well,
Go ahead, Leanne.
Want to be a voice of the people, and just looking at the comments that we're receiving, there are a lot of people who are fascinated with the journalist who fell in love with LaRue and have many questions about if they're still together, how it happened. And I think what people's fascination about it is, it's almost as if you question yourself and you say, but could that have happened to me? You know, am I that vulnerable?
Isn't that the same question that people ask who, you know, if I look at the victims, the realtor, financial advisor, that could have been me. I'm a journalist that pitch up for meetings all the time. I meet people at strange places. That could have been me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead, Leanne.
So, I mean, do you know what's happened since with the journalist?
Yeah. She revealed in a report that she's not together with LaRue anymore. But I do tell people, and that's literally just from professional courtesy, we are colleagues in the industry. So I prefer not to comment on her story specifically.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's interesting.
I don't really have any questions. I just hope you don't live in Krugersdorp. Okay. Thank God. That's...
You visited a lot of these places, and obviously in putting the documentary together, you had to revisit a number of things about the case. Were there any really strange things that happened as a result of that? Was there new evidence discovered? Were there funny things that you saw that you hadn't seen before?
I think what's really interesting is while I was writing the book, I didn't speak to the insurer, the insurance company that was involved with this fraud. Mm. But if you watch the documentary, he had a very elaborate contribution to the docu, which was extremely interesting. And one thing is actually, the director shared this with me because he was there interviewing Shane. And he said at one point, Shane just casually mentioned that, you know, he was doing the interview with Cecilia in the Kusana flats. And then he just went outside. He said he wanted to go get something in the car. But actually, this guy was so good. He was actually looking around for CCTV cameras to see if he can get any more evidence because he realized, oh my goodness, something is not right. And I can imagine him knowing that something is off. He wanted to know, wanted to make sure that he's being watched while being there. I mean, we later discovered that people were killed in that very apartment block. God.
Are there people living in those flats now?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
We actually, you know, we actually visited them. Yeah, it was probably a year what ago. I took the cop, the investigative officer, with me so he can do the introduction. And the people living in Cecilia's very flat didn't even know what happened there. I don't think they appreciate that us
happened there. They were probably,
but at least I know now.
In blissful ignorance. People should know, but yeah. I mean, they probably wouldn't have chosen to stay there if they'd known. So Vince asks this.
Exactly.
Why did they never bother covering up their murders? They left tracks shamelessly all over the place. What do you say to that?
Amateurs. They wanted to. They had a plan. For example, don't shoot people. We don't leave ballistic evidence. And then Marinda will go and accidentally, out of shock, shoot someone in the stomach. You know, so
Jesus.
No, it's just amateur moves. That's all.
Yeah, there are lots of people who are very interested in the circumstances and the capabilities these people have for evil. Mm-hmm. But the most ugly thing about it, I suppose, is that, you know, you can't hide these things, and ultimately it will all come out. And mm-hmm. and it sounds so much worse when you have to retell it. And to do this documentary, you must have had a pretty tough time deciding what to keep in and what to leave out. Because there's so much story. Like you can't fit it all in.
Yes.
Even in a 4-piece series, you know. You have to leave some stuff on the floor.
I think the one main purpose or motivation for documentary is to tell the victim stories. Yes, Cecilia plays a very, very big role in all of it. We all know that. But there was a very definite decision to not interview them. We could, the production team could. I mean, it was COVID times, but they could apply with court and all that. But we realized, you know, this is the victim story. So we want to tell the story factually. Correct, accurate, and Cecilia, again, is not going to contribute in any, she's not going to contribute with anything worth adding to the facts. So we decided we're not going to give them that attention that they crave. We're going to focus on the story as it is. And yeah, quite frankly, I know they will not be happy about it, which makes me very happy because we don't want to give them satisfaction at all.
So what's the latest?
Jana, a personal question.
Sorry, before you go, Mbulelo, what's the latest on Cecilia? Where's she in jail at the moment, and what's she up to?
Cecilia and Marinda are both in Sun City Prison. That's the Johannesburg Central Prison, in the old CMAX. That's what they call the section. The guys are there as well, Leru and Zach Valentine. Marcel is not in a prison with them. I know where she is, but she's been transferred because her mother threatened to kill her.
Nice.
So, yeah, that's hectic. So she had to be transferred. But apparently, Cecilia is now running her own little, what do I say, cell group, no pun intended, but counseling group in prison. So she's informally counseling people, and that makes me extremely worried. Because you can imagine, she won't see the outside world in her life again, but many people will, and they will leave prison with Cecilia on their mind. So that's quite worrisome.
It's unbelievable. Go ahead, Mbulelo. I interrupted you.
Jana, just with you sort of doing this kind of work, a friend of mine who's a lawyer says he's starting to enjoy his work less and less because nobody calls a lawyer when things are going well. And so for you, is that when you keep having to kind of do the sort of research, and it is your job. Do you lose faith in humanity, or are you able to still write your stories from a sort of neutral point of view? And I guess that's a professionalism thing, but just on a personal note, as a storyteller, are you still able to see the best in mankind so that you can write the stories sort of objectively, or does it sort of I don't want to talk to anyone anywhere.
Now, I think we get a lot of exposure to many different kinds of stories. It's not only, you know, crime and death and murder and Krugersdorp killings and all that. So, and even in the position I am now working, I'm an in-depth reporter. So I do more analytical, more longer pieces, more in-depth pieces. So sometimes I won't focus on crime, and I will focus on, I don't know, it's maybe a great new experiment in COVID science or whatever. So there's, I try to, and I pitch my stories to keep that balance exactly for that reason. I mean, I don't want to be confronted with all the negative stuff the whole time.
Well,
but I don't always see it as negative as well. Sorry, Gareth. I see it as my purpose to inform people. So I can be angry at the anti-vaxxers.
Yeah.
Or I can decide to write an informative piece, and maybe three people will change their minds, and then my job's done.
Jean says we need a Devilsdorp 2, an interview of Marinda and her kids. I mean, there are people asking for all kinds of things here. Just quickly, Gary says this. Gary says, how did they choose my colleague, Hanalei? So obviously, Hanalei, one of the victims.
Yeah. Also, very, very sad. And like I've said, the senseless of these killings. You know, Marinda paged through the newspaper and saw, oh, there's a Remax ad.
Jesus.
Let's call this lady. She knew, she didn't know her from a bar of soap. She just called. It could have been you and me.
Unbelievable.
Sure.
Scary. Listen, well done. I mean, all I can say is congratulations on putting an absolutely insane story together and helping us to understand, or at least to try to understand, the madness that goes on in plain sight and with people that are randomly walking past you in the shops. Who knows that some of us haven't met Cecilia or walked past her or, you know, driven past her flat. Who knows? And to have known that all of this craziness was happening there and then, it's just very, very scary.
Yeah. And just the fact that it would have always just been bits of stories of the story, which were swept under the carpet and lost in the noise of news that we hear every day. And I have so much respect for someone who sits and pieces all of that together and takes out a huge chunk of their life. And it can affect your mental health too, to sit there and piece together everything and make it into something that'll try to help people understand what happened. I think it's amazing and huge respect.
I have to applaud Captain Ben Boyson. I mean, he did an amazing job. After all the issues with the investigation, he just came and he took over everyone's dockets and he solved this case. I mean,
it's great.
He's kind of like Superman in my eyes.
We give the police such a hard time in this country, but we have some incredibly, incredibly talented and hardworking police people. Listen, Jana, congrats. We could talk to you all morning, but we've got to go, and I know you do too. Keep doing the good work.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gareth, there we go.
There's Jana Marks, who's the author of the book, which if you haven't already looked at, you need to check that out, first of all, as the first stop, the Krugersdorp cult killings, Inside Cecilia Steyn's Reign of Terror. That's Jana Marks. She's also the narrator of the series. We're joined now by George, who has never been to the West Rand either. So, George, you can't add anything to these killings. You've never been to the East Rand. I mean, the West Rand, have you? You're on the East Rand.
I've been there, got a few customers there,
but
I don't go there unless I have to.
All right, so what's happening, George? What's on your agenda for this Friday morning?
Got a few staff that live there. Got to wonder now.
You're lucky they're still around after Cecilia Steyn. All right, so what do we got going on today?
So, Gareth, you know... car companies traditionally for the last 100 years have created cars that you buy. You buy the features when you buy the car. So, for instance, if you wanted in the past electric windows, you bought it when you ordered the car and you got electric windows. Or, you know, there were days where you could have an optional extra called an aircon. I don't know if you remember when cars were without aircons.
I used to have a Golf, a City Golf or a Chico or whatever they were called, and there was no aircon in there. If you were warm in your car in the summer, you had to open the windows, for God's sake.
Exactly. And in Joburg's heat, it can get a little bit hair-raising. But
even power steering was an option.
That's true. I remember the Golf Chicos with no power steering.
Yep.
But in today's world, car companies are starting to become more and more platform businesses. Now, if you go and look at my YouTube account or my Instagram account, I talk about platform businesses and businesses wanting to become subscription businesses. Mm-hmm. Cliff Central is a platform business. And most businesses want to become that. Auto Trader is a platform business and a subscription business.
Right.
So now cars are becoming platform and subscription businesses in the following way. So the Tesla Model 3 comes equipped with a long-range battery pack. All of them are equipped with long-range battery packs. Mm-hmm. And you can order software updates by paying a subscription annually that you didn't pay for at the beginning when you bought the car to get the longer range out of the car.
Wow.
Mercedes-Benz have rear wheel steering on their cars. Okay. They don't switch it on unless you pay the R8,500 annual subscription for the rear wheel steering. BMW used to charge for Apple CarPlay. They charged R1,200 connection fee, which they then enabled over the internet if you chose to do it, if you didn't buy Apple CarPlay at the beginning. And then there was a revolt, and Apple CarPlay, is now standard feature. So we can in the future start to see car app stores where you can start to buy features for your car to upgrade.
Makes sense. I mean, I know that it sounds to people, you're trying to rope me in on extras and now you're going to make me pay for things that I should have got for free. But some of these things are not for free and you should be paying a subscription for them, for heaven's sake, because they add extra value. It's like, you can go onto the internet and you can buy a game and you can buy the add-ons to that game.
Exactly. And you can, and we all know in the gaming world, if you played games when you were younger, you could, buy the next level or you could buy the next part of the game. And cars are becoming exactly the same thing. BMW's got the connected drive store where you can go and buy upgrades. So in the future, cars will come fully stacked, I think. And it's also cheaper for manufacturers to make one car. So one model of a car, don't have to worry about, okay, this car needs electric windows, this car needs an aircon. You just make it fully stacked and you turn it off via software updates. And imagine how much simpler the factory gets.
And then also you'll end up with a whole cottage industry of hackers who will be able to do that stuff for you for free, who will disintermediate the manufacturers on that level because they'll know that the stuff's already installed and they'll be able to hack the system to get it switched on for you. So that's obviously the next level.
If you think Gareth is just talking about fantasy, it's a reality. If you remember back in 2008, 2009, 2010, and it even happens today, jailbreaking iPhones. If you came across jailbreak, so that's exactly what happened to Apple. And then you could access a third party store. So it wouldn't surprise me if this begins to happen.
Very, very good. All right.
And then Ford. You know the Ford F-150, which is a fully electric, what in America calls truck, which is a bucky. So there was a wedding that was going on. And if you want the link to the video, I can post it. But there was a wedding. And the power went out at this wedding in the United States. I don't think they've got load shedding, but somehow there was a power failure.
Yes.
And it's before the wedding started. And there were two guests who had Ford F-150s. Now, if you know the Ford F-150, it's got 120 and 220 volt plugs in the bucky section of the
unreal
of the truck.
Right. Where you put the bakuzi.
There where you put the – no, you can't put the bakuzi. Not in that truck. You will get
any more.
So what the wedding organizers did was they ran extension cords and this wedding went ahead like clockwork using the Ford F-150's 120 volt plugs.
That's awesome.
Amazing.
You think that speeding only happens in South Africa. In Derbyshire, England, I'm not sure if that's part of the West Rand of England or not.
Why do you say that, Derbyshire? Why do you say that's the West Rand?
I'm just guessing two and two, you know, maybe it's the East End. I don't know. I live here, so it's fine.
All right.
But a Mercedes-Benz AMG G63 driver was nabbed at 209 kilometers an hour. And guess what his excuse was?
What? He was in a hurry.
Needed to poop.
He needed to go to the toilet.
Oh, no, really? That was his excuse.
And then, finally, Gareth, the DMV evaluators, which is a car testing company like the license departments in South Africa in the US, they are failing people who come to their facility with electric cars.
Really? Why?
Yes. And it turns out that this one driver who made a big stink about it, and this story then surfaced, he went and did his driving test and failed. So he asked why. And the instructor said, well, the car wasn't set to chill mode and the steering wasn't set to comfort. And then while you were driving, I could feel that the car was braking and you weren't pushing the brake pedal.
Oh my God! So this is nonsense. This is just like this is where like the Stone Age meets the modern age.
Exactly.
Jeez.
So people are failing their driving tests because the instructors want all the technology on the car switched off.
Yeah.
In order for you to pass your driving test.
It's ridiculous. Wow. Ridiculous.
Wow.
So I wonder what's going to happen in South Africa. Somebody a driving test in South Africa in an I-Pace or a Mini SE or something, and I'd be interested to see
who gave you your license, your driver's test. Because I remember there was this old Oom. He was like an old Afrikaans Oom who was my driver's license guy, and he was. I don't even know if he was awake during most of my test because. He looked like he was probably about 85 years old in the shade, and clearly he'd done this so many times that for him, the most exciting thing that could have happened is that I could have crashed, but luckily that didn't happen. So eventually, by my second or third try, I got it right. This old man would definitely not have known what to do with an electric car. There's no way.
But also, Gareth, that was 20 plus years ago.
No.
So I'm sure it might be a bit different now. And drivers, I mean, instructors are used to seeing more technology. But I remember mine told me that I'd failed and I was distraught and I was crying because it was my birthday. And then he said, I'm only joking. You passed. I mean, who does that?
Sadist. That's
hopefully they've changed.
Oh man, that's funny.
All right, George, what else?
Well, I've got one more story if you'd like. Chery South Africa has officially launched and they're opening up 30 dealerships. Now, this is another Chinese brand. So, you know, Haval has entered the country.
Yes.
And these Chinese brands are coming into the market and absolutely decimating car prices, which is a good thing for the consumer.
Sure.
And these cars aren't too bad, actually.
Well, those Cherries, I've seen a couple of them around, and they obviously are, you know, good value for money. Whether or not they're the kind of car that everybody dreams about, I doubt. But good for them that anybody who can expand their business in the last couple of years deserves all the praise we can give them, right?
Yes, and they're bringing the EQ1 and the EQ5 as well, which are full electric vehicles.
Good for them. All right. So that's Chery, Chery.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Mm-hmm. All right, George. Good stuff. We've had a nice time this morning. That Devil's Door discussion was really, really cool too. You can go and listen to the podcast if you missed anything. And we will see you on Monday at 6 o'clock, bright and early. Have a good weekend, everybody. Cheers. CliffCentral.com.